Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today are Clayton Michaels and Allie McNichols from Aspen High School, and Marcus Lutie, professor of physics at the University of California, Davis. Marcus' dad was a physicist, and he became a physicist because of all of the many interesting scientists from around the world who came to his house for dinner, and because his dad got to wear shorts to work. He studied at the University of Utah and University of Chicago, did postdoctoral work at Berkeley and MIT, and has held faculty positions at the University of Maryland and the University of California, Davis, where he now works. His main research interest is in the theory of elementary particles, concentrating on physics beyond the standard model. His topics include supersymmetry breaking, extra dimensions, gravity, cosmology, which sounds like a universally large array of topics. And welcome, Marcus, to Radio Physics.
Thank you very much.
How did you get interested in particle physics?
I was just drawn to the very most basic questions about why the world is the way it is. And it seems that particle physics has a lot to say about that.
Back to the fundamentals. So what is it really like being a physicist in your job? What does your work day usually look like?
Well, what I tell people, for example, my brother, who's a musician, and when musicians ask me what it is that I actually do, what I tell them is that I do homework for a living. So I'm a theoretical physicist, so except they're homework problems that I give myself, right? And so, of course, I'm also teaching, and so I spend about half of my time, you know, doing lectures, preparing lectures, doing those kinds of things, talking with students. And actually mentoring students at the advanced level, at the graduate level, is one of the great pleasures of the job. And then the other half of my time I spend thinking about problems that I chose to think about. One of the really great things that actually also really got me interested in physics is that nobody can tell you what to do. People do eventually either give you or not give you grant money, so there's some evaluation, but nobody tells you, okay, today you have to do this, at least to an amazing extent.
What has been your greatest accomplishment?
That's a tough one for me. I like to think I'm a modest person, but there are certain papers that I've written that I feel very good about, because I feel that in some perhaps small way I've contributed to understanding of a topic that other people care about. And so one example has to do with the properties of baryons. So baryons are particles like protons and neutrons. In the modern theory of strong interactions, the force that holds these particles together is got three so-called color degrees of freedom. They're not really colors, but that's just the name that we give them. And it turns out that the theory simplifies where if instead of three colors, you have a large number of colors. And so as a postdoc, a colleague of mine and I, we worked out some of the properties of baryons when you have a very large number of colors. And that was a problem that had been studied previously, but we made some new advances. And so that was my first taste of success as a theoretical physicist. And then there have been other things that are maybe more technical, but things involving supersymmetry breaking. But it's always when you feel like you've made an advance on some problem. That's a really fantastic feeling.
So you work with the Large Hadron Collider, correct?
It would be a little bit of a stretch to say I work with it. I mean, I'm a theorist, and they wouldn't let me anywhere near it.
Okay.
But I definitely think about what's going on there.
Right. So from your perspective, how do you think the idea of the Hadron Collider came to be?
Well, the idea is a very, very old one, actually. So it actually goes back to at least the 1930s. So in the 1930s, Enrico Fermi proposed a theory of what are called the weak interactions. So weak interactions are responsible, for example, for beta decay, so the luminous dials on a watch. It's a certain kind of radioactivity, and it was quite mysterious how it worked. And he proposed a theory called Fermi's theory, and people made fun of his theory because it broke down at energies that were astronomically large for the energies that people were able to probe at that time, but it broke down at this energy scale called a TeV. And you can fast forward now 80 years, and the thing is that this scale that was basically found by Fermi, where Fermi's theory broke down, is finally the scale where the Higgs boson was discovered. So the full resolution of what fixes Fermi's theory was just discovered in 2012 at the Large Hadron Collider. So we've known, Fermi knew already in the 1930s, that we needed to be able to probe this energy scale. And the way you probe an energy scale of very high energies in elementary particle physics is actually not very imaginative. You just take particles and you bang them together with that energy, okay? And then you see what flies out. And that's exactly what the Large Hadron Collider is. So the idea, in a way, came from way, way back when. Mm-hmm. Of course, the technology is advanced a lot since the 1930s.
So you mentioned supersymmetry breaking earlier. Can you just explain that a bit?
Yeah, I guess first I should back up to say what supersymmetry is. And I'm afraid that if I have to back up probably even one step further and say something about what the standard model is. So with the discovery of the Higgs boson in 2012, this was an absolutely amazing watershed discovery, as I've sort of said. And it really completes what's called the standard model of particle physics, which currently explains all the interactions of elementary particles. It explains everything that we know exists, which is quite an amazing accomplishment. And with the discovery of the Higgs boson, it's not like the case where Fermi's theory, where it broke down at some energy scale that you could imagine probing, which we now finally have probed. The standard model works to essentially arbitrarily high energy scales, or so astronomically high that we have no hope of probing them. Some people are worried that particle physics is just over. We have the final theory. But there's a glaring problem in the standard model, at least an apparent glaring problem, and that is that the mass of the Higgs boson is very unstable to quantum corrections, so to quantum fluctuations. There seems to be no reason why the Higgs boson is as light as it is. Now, supersymmetry is a new symmetry of space and time that was invented to, it does a fantastic job of explaining why the Higgs boson is light. The only problem is that we have not seen any sign of supersymmetry. Supersymmetry would predict that for every particle, there's a partner particle. For example, for the Higgs particle, there's a Higgsino. For every fermion we've seen, there's some scalar particle, okay? And we don't see those particles. And that's okay because the symmetry does not have to be exact. So it has to be broken in some way. And so that's the subject of supersymmetry breaking. So it's, you can sort of see it's several steps removed from reality as we know it, but we have very high hopes that this is the right direction and that some of this, that supersymmetry breaking will be important.
What kind of new material are you discovering now for particle physics?
The Higgs boson is an example of a discovery that's the most recent discovery in particle physics. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I can't really say that it's a material because what happens when we discover this particle, these particles are not lying around anywhere. They are literally made at the Large Hadron Collider. They are made by turning energy into particles.
Okay.
And then almost as soon as they are made, within a tiny, tiny fraction of a second, it's so small of a fraction of a second, even though these Higgs bosons are moving nearly the speed of light when they're created, they still don't move the distance of an atomic distance. In that short of a time, the Higgs boson just decays. It falls apart. So it exists for this tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of a second. Nonetheless, by looking at the debris from its decay, physicists are able to infer that it's there. But you can't build anything out of it because it decays right away. Physicists are certainly looking for new things that are actually stable particles, and if we find those, that would be an amazing discovery. We haven't found any new stable particles so far.
So we heard mentioned that you're also interested in cosmology. Can you just say a little bit about what you do there?
I haven't been as active in cosmology, but primarily the aspect of cosmology I've been interested in is dark matter. So it's now for sure known that if you weigh the matter in the universe, and you do that basically by looking at the gravitational effects, there's a lot of matter. Most of the matter of the universe is not visible. So we see stars, and we know about dust, and we can see dust from the fact that dust scatters light. But that's only makes up about 5% of the mass of the universe. Maybe it's not 5%. I think it's a quarter. Anyway, it's a small fraction. But the other part of the mass of the universe is an unknown substance, and it's called dark matter. Dark matter is just a placeholder for that. It's one of the most compelling possibilities is that dark matter is actually a new type of stable particle that we are looking for at the Large Hadron Collider. So that's something maybe I should have mentioned when you asked about new material, because making dark matter at the Large Hadron Collider is one of the main motivations for actually building that machine. And so I've been thinking about various aspects, different kinds of particles that dark matter could be, different theoretical frameworks, things like that.
With your work with particle physics and stuff, can you tell us from your point of view how the atom is configured with quarks and such, and how you discovered that, how it was discovered?
How it was discovered. Well, it was a long, long road. I mean, I think the sort of big first step was Rutherford. Mm-hmm. When people were trying to figure out what the atom was like, you know, Rutherford had this idea of just bombarding the atom with alpha particles. And what he discovered was, so because you can't look at an atom under a microscope, right? It's so small that light can't resolve it, right? And so he banged it with particles. And what he discovered was that occasionally these heavy alpha particles going into the atom bounced straight back, right? Or nearly straight back. And so that was the discovery of the nucleus, okay? Mm-hmm. Because up to that point, people just, they knew that there were atoms, but they didn't know what the internal structure of the atoms was like. And Rutherford, like I said, he bombarded the atom, and looking at what came out, discovered something very important, the existence of the nucleus. And ever since then, we've been doing the same thing, doing the same experiment, just banging things and looking to see what comes out. And that's how the structure of all of these particles was inferred. So, for example, to understand that the nucleus is made out of protons and neutrons, and the protons and neutrons themselves are made out of quarks, one just bombards them harder and harder and kind of repeats the same kind of analysis that Rutherford did. If there is a big object that's made out of smaller hard objects, then occasionally when you send something in, it comes bouncing straight back because it hits one of those little hard cores. That's really the essence of the idea. I mean, it's more mathematically sophisticated than that in its detail, but that really is the basic idea.
You're listening to KDNK Radio, Carbondale, Colorado, and this is Radio Physics, an interview between one of the physicists visiting the Aspen Center for Physics, in this case, Marcus Luthi of the University of California, Davis, and two high school rising seniors. Today we have Clayton Michaels and Allie McNichols interviewing. Thank you for listening.
So what do you think is like the next big step for particle physics?
We are at a very, very interesting place right now because the Large Hadron Collider is just starting operation again with a very significant increase in energy, and it is also going to collect more collisions. So every time you have a collision, there's some small chance of a collision being really interesting. And so, you know, both having more energy and having more collisions are both there's a tremendous possibility that the Large Hadron Collider could discover, for example, supersymmetry or dark matter or signs of extra dimensions. There's a long list of amazing things that could very, very well be discovered. On the other hand, we have been a bit humbled because the simplest versions of these fantastic ideas probably should have shown up already at the last run of the Large Hadron Collider. Our field, and I'm reflecting this, I think, to some extent, is a bit schizophrenic. Part of my brain wants to say, oh my, you know, the discovery is just around the corner. It has to be there. And then there's a part of me that's saying, maybe we're really missing something because it really should have shown up before that. And in a way, that's sort of my research program. So certainly, to answer your question, the next big step is to see what happens in the next few years. The next few years are going to be one of those times where the chances for discovering something really amazing, something that will make the Higgs boson look like a footnote, is very, very high.
And so you said you worked with cosmology. Do you think about the theories of the expansion of the universe and things like that?
So the expansion of the universe, accounting for what causes the universe to expand, is, you know, a big part of cosmology. And the amazing thing is that most of that is not matter that we know about here on Earth. So I talked about dark matter. Dark matter is an important part of that. And then actually it turns out the late stages of the universe today is being driven by yet another form of, it's not even matter, it's just some energy called dark energy. Again, because we don't know what it is, it's called dark energy. And so I do spend some of my time trying to think about that, but most of my personal research is mainly on particles and things that we can hopefully actually make at the Large Hadron Collider.
What suggestions would you give to a student who is interested in particle physics?
I think the first thing I would say is go for it. It's a great privilege to be a scientist. It's a fantastic career. For a person who's interested in it, I don't think there's anything, I can't think of a better kind of job. I don't know. I think as far as advice goes, I really am a great believer in really following your passion. You know, I am a great believer in that. But I also believe that once somebody has got enough to eat and a warm place to sleep, then talent is just uniformly distributed throughout the population of the world. And so wherever you are, wherever you come from, I think that, you know, you should follow your dreams. We need, science always needs new people, needs new ideas, you know, so just, yeah, follow your dreams. That's what I would say.
What would you say are the biggest challenges of your work?
I guess the thing I struggle most with is feeling worthless, feeling like what I'm doing doesn't really matter, because there is a sense in which if I personally went away, probably the field would go on without me. It would probably not delay any major discoveries in any major way. You know, I'm not one of those people who are the absolute linchpins of physics or of particle physics. On the other hand, you need people like me. You might not need me, but you definitely need people like me if you want the field to continue. And I personally sometimes, you know, have a problem with, you know, am I personally really contributing anything? And that's, I guess, what I struggle with the most.
So what are just some of the highs and the lows of working as a physicist?
Oh, the highs are easy. Coming here to the Aspen Center for Physics is one of them. I mean, this is a place where people congregate. Everybody is focused on their research. They come here in the summertime, and there's a lot of discussion. Another thing I really love is collaborating with people all over the world. As was said in the introduction, you know, growing up as a kid in Salt Lake City, Utah, is a bit of an isolated place in the 1970s, especially. It was just really eye-opening for me to meet people from China, Russia, India, South America, all over Europe, you know, you name it. And so now I really love collaborating with people all over the world, the fact that science is an international thing. The lows, I don't know, I guess it's kind of what I said. Sometimes I feel worthless. Sometimes I'll spend a few months thinking about something which I think might be a brilliant idea, you know, and then it turns out it's really dumb. You know, it's just completely stupid. And then I feel worthless. I feel like, what am I doing? I'm wasting my time. I'm wasting the taxpayers' time. I'm worthless. But then somehow, I think anybody who does this sort of field, they have to have, against all the empirical evidence, I wake up every morning and thinking, today might be the day. Today might be the day where I make some major discovery. And even though that hasn't been true so far, I think that attitude is pretty important.
What have been your most recent successes in your work?
Probably my most recent success was And this is, yeah, this maybe kind of will show you how twisted sometimes science can be, or unexpected, how things can happen unexpectedly. So I wrote a paper with a colleague of mine where this basic glaring problem of the standard model, I didn't tell you exactly what it is, but it's called the hierarchy problem. And we phrased it in a new way, and we proposed a new kind of possibility for how it might be resolved. And this possibility involved an exotic kinds of quantum field theories that had not been intensively studied for a long time, called conformal field theories, or they had been studied, but special examples of them had been studied, but we were looking at very generic kinds of conformal field theories, and we said that if you had a certain kind of this conformal field theory with certain properties, that would solve this hierarchy problem, okay? And that was our paper. And, you know, this idea that we proposed has been completely ruled out by the discovery of the Higgs boson, okay? However, what it did is some other people, including some of my close collaborators and colleagues through the years, they looked at this proposal and they said, well, we need to rule this out, right? Because we're good friends with Ludi, we're gonna rule out this mm-hmm. idea. And this led them to theoretically study these kinds of theories, conformal field theories in general, and they made a really important advance in understanding those theories. And in fact, the workshop I'm at right here, right now, at Aspen Center for Physics, is largely devoted to exactly studying that question. So in a way, my contribution to the subject was kind of asking the right question. Okay, so even though the kinds of idea we proposed doesn't describe the world, trying to rule that out led to a whole new field, which is now the subject of, you know, many workshops and conferences and so on.
Could you just go a little bit more in depth about like what conformal field theories are?
Okay. So one of the most basic things about nature is that if you look at nature on different distance scales, it looks completely different, right? If we look at the world around us, it doesn't look anything like the atomic world, okay? However, there are theories where the theories are look the same at every distance scale. At every distance scale, they look self-similar. Now, they can't describe our world as we see it, but it might be that when you get to very, very short distances, it stops changing. That basically, when you get to shorter and shorter distances, physics looks more and more the same. So conformal field theory is this word conformal basically means scale invariant. And it turns out that as far as we know, once you have the scale invariant, you get an additional bunch of symmetries. Those are the ones that are actually called conformal symmetries. And I'm sorry, those I would have no hope of being able to explain over the radio. But the point is that these theories have a large amount of symmetry, and that is catnip for physicists, because if you have a large amount of symmetry, you can say a lot about these theories. And so quantum field theory is the general language that we use to describe nature at its most fundamental. Quantum field theory is what you get when you combine special relativity and quantum mechanics. And so that we're able to make progress in understanding this special class of conformal field theories is just theoretically interesting. And it may very well be that if we go to short enough distances, that this is the way that nature works.
You've been listening to Radio Physics on KDNK Radio. Thank you so much, Professor Ludi from the University of California, Davis, Clayton Michaels and Alec McNichols from Aspen High School, who have been interviewing Professor Ludi.